Greetings from the land of Boris. Lovely to see you. Great to be here. Thanks for not sitting in the front row. I always find the front row necessarily left empty, so thank you for doing that, because that would be awful, wouldn't it, if you sat in the front row? I mean, how embarrassing that would be. Good, well, let's turn to the book of James, shall we? And today's a mixture of me talking and you doing lots of work. And the aim really is for us to get some kind of feel of an overview of the book. And the reason for that is so that we can then study it more and teach it to others. And that's the hope for today. So all the way through, I hope you'll be thinking, where am I going to teach this? How can I pass this on to others? So you were asked to do some preparation for today, and you're now thinking, oh yes, so I was. So we're going to start with a test. I'm just going to go along the row. I'm going to ask each person in turn to tell us exactly. No, I'm not. I'm kinder than that. What I'd like you to do is to turn to into little groups of two or three. We're going to do this quite a bit during the day, so it's probably worth working out now how you're going to turn into your little group rather than just turning to the neighbour next to you. So we'll turn into groups of, say, three or four. Did I say two or three? Three or four. Let's say into groups of three or four. Turn your chairs if necessary now, because we're going to be in these little groups for 10 minutes now. And what I'd like to do is to talk about your first thoughts of what you think the book of James is about, and particularly what you think is the big idea of the book. So let's turn chairs, not just kind of lean awkwardly, but move yourself around to actually facing other people. And let's spend 10 minutes or so talking together about what we've seen so far. Okay, let's come back together again. I don't know how you got on with that task, either in working at it at home or talking about it now. James, of course, is tricky. We think it shouldn't be tricky because it is, after all, a letter that has got 54 imperatives in it. So it has been described as a book where the author is, quote, interested in practical Christianity. Which, of course, is a slightly odd description, isn't it? As if that's kind of exceptional. You know, that here is a writer that at long last is interested in practical Christianity as opposed to all the other Bible writers that aren't, would seem to be the assumption. But of course, all Bible truth is applied truth. All sermons have to be practical. But we think a practical letter like James, with all these imperatives, ought to be easy to preach. But actually, it's tricky. And one of the things that makes James tricky is that common idea that the letter is all random. So is it practical Christianity? Well, the idea is maybe it's all just random, that there's no real structure, there's no central theme. It has been described as the equivalent, the New Testament equivalent of Old Testament wisdom literature. And the idea being that all wisdom literature is just sort of randomly bunged together stuff with no clear organization. I don't think that's a terribly helpful description of wisdom literature either, actually. But the idea that James is kind of sort of like a blog, really, and there's no connection between one blog post and the next. You're just writing on anything that happens to take his fancy. And if there's any Bible book that invites that sort of bland paragraph heading, final instructions or some other thoughts, you think, well, that might apply to James, kind of some thoughts and another paragraph, some other thoughts. And then another paragraph, still further thoughts. And that makes it a tricky book, I think. But it is, of course, preaching 101, that each Bible book has something distinctive to say, something coherent, something sustained. It's got its own unique message. It's got its own big idea. And that is what, in Proclamation Trust circles, we've called the melodic line of a book, the big idea of a Bible book. There used to be a TV game show called Name That Tune. And in that show, contestants would hear just a snatch of melody, and you had to give its title. And if you knew your stuff, if you're going to win the prize, then you just need those few notes. And that was enough to give away the entire song. And our job as Bible readers, to follow that with that same analogy, our job as Bible readers is to listen well enough and long enough to a Bible book. and so that we can trace that tune all the way through a Bible book. And then use that so that we can work out what the whole of the book is driving at, and we can understand each individual snatch of melody and say how that fits into the whole. So to know James's main purpose in writing, his melodic line, and to trace that tune all the way through. And I suppose the reason for that is to ensure that what we're saying on any bit is actually what the author meant to say. And looking at the book as a whole does make a difference to how you understand an individual bit. In other words, not just taking a little phrase out and just snipping it away from all the other verses around it and just preaching on that text, irrelevant of where that text is set, but to try to understand the whole and how this individual text fits into that. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to spend some time thinking about the melodic line of the letter. What is James's overarching, controlling purpose? Now, the beginning and the end of a letter, a book, are often a good place to look, to try to get a feel for that. And that is true in James here. So we're going to start in the last two verses of James, chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. I'm going to read the verses and I'm going to put you straight back into your little groups, turn around again. And you'll see on the first page of the handout these two questions. What is the danger and what can be done about it? So let me read 19 and 20 and then you talk about these two verses together. My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. So what's the danger? What can be done about it? Talk in your groups again. There's a 5 second answer, and there's an answer that's worth thinking about. So don't be satisfied with a 5 second answer. Okay, good. Let's come back together. So the danger then, first of all, the danger is, 5 second answer, wandering off, wandering from the truth. You're driving down the motorway, it's late, you're following a driver, and you notice that the driver in front of you seems to be, stay back. he's veering all over the road. I think he's falling asleep at the wheel. And you see him jerking back onto line, almost imperceptibly, but no, he's definitely drifting towards the hard shoulder. That sleepy head is drifting. And that's the image here in verse 19, and that is the clear and present danger. And the scenario that the whole letter is written to address, that the Christian veering off the path from the true course, wandering from the truth, in other words, from the Christian gospel that we've heard and received. The need is bringing back, and you'll see that phrase comes twice. It comes at the end of verse 19, someone brings him back, beginning of verse 20, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner. You need help to come back. There needs to be a search and rescue helicopter that's sent out to find the wanderer and bring them back. And who is that person? Who is it that is to do the bringing back? Well, someone. There's a story told about four people. Their names were everyone, someone, anyone, and no one. And there was an important job to be done, and everyone was sure that someone would do it. Anyone could have done it, but no one did it. Someone got angry about that because it was everyone's job. And everyone thought that anyone could do it, but no one realised that everyone wouldn't do it. So it ended up that everyone blamed someone when no one did what anybody could have done. Anyway, if someone brings him back, someone, so anyone could do it. But will it be the case that everyone thought that someone else would do it? Now, you may feel in reaction to that, yeah, but it's not my place, is it? Am I my brother's keeper? But this passage makes it clear that it really is. Now, I reckon there are two problems with this. The first is that we're afraid to go and do the bringing back. We sort of hold back from doing it. The other is that we do it, but we're insensitive or pushy in the way that we do the bringing back. And I think I've probably been guilty of both of those things. Sometimes holding back when I should have got involved, sometimes getting involved, but in too pushy a way. We do need to be brave, and we do need to be gentle, but we do need to do it. We are our brothers and our sisters' keeper, and it's the responsibility of every Christian, anyone, someone, because Christians are family. And the result here is that the soul is saved. And look what the soul is saved from. You see where sin leads to death. That is eternal death, not just the death that we die at the end of our lives. But here it's clear it's the opposite of salvation, isn't it? You are either saved or you face death. And I have a part to play in that. I do can change the destiny for a wanderer. He can be saved from death. How's that going to happen? Interesting, isn't it? Look again, who actually does the saving in this verse? We do. Now, obviously, we can't be each other's Jesus. We can't be the architect of somebody's salvation. But we can be involved in saving somebody from spiritual death. And that's why it's such a crucial ministry. That's what we should, why we should all do what these verses say, to be sinners bringers back, to be wanderer savers, to be the soul salvation society. Remember that song in the Italian Job when they're all in the prison and they're banging their cups? What do they all sing then? Not "We're the Soul Salvation Society." What is it? We're da, 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 da. That's right, self-preservation. Anyway, not that at all. Not at all the message of that movie. Not self-preservation, but Soul Salvation Society. Actually, there is a denomination in Egypt called the Soul Salvation Society, which is a very good name, isn't it? And look at the way the last phrase of these verses describes it, that the sin of the wandering sinner is covered. Actually, a multitude of their sins, loads of them, are covered. Covered doesn't mean there's some kind of cover-up. It's not that God shoves it under the carpet and say, "Oh, let's pretend it didn't happen then. Let's kind of forget it. Between friends, you don't need to mention it again." Covering is a lovely word from the Old Testament to describe what God actually does with sin, how he forgives it. Just turn quickly to Psalm 32. Let me just show you one other place where this phrase gets used. Psalm 32, you might have already immediately thought of this verse. "Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered." You see that covering and forgiveness are parallel to one another in this verse. Or to put it another way, beginning of verse 2, "The man against whom the Lord counts no iniquity." Actually, any covering up, pretending about sin, the wrong kind of covering, is in verses 3 and 4, isn't it? "When I kept silent, when I pretended I hadn't done sin, when I was covering it up in the bad way. But when I brought it into the open and my sin was forgiven, that's when the Lord covered it." And I wonder if it's a bit like, we use the word in the same way, you know, when you're out for dinner with some friends it gets to the end of the meal and it's that awkward moment of who's going to pay and how you're going to arrange the bill. Actually, it's not your problem in Scotland, is it? You know, it's the other person's job to pay. Sorry, racial stereotyping, I can't resist it, I'm so sorry. Anyway, you're out for dinner and you're thinking who's going to pay the bill. And then the other person says, "Oh, don't worry about that, I've got that covered." Meaning not, "Let's just pretend we didn't pay, and we didn't cause anything, let's just walk out, call it quits." No, I will deal with it. And that's what God does with our sin. God says, "Don't worry, I've got those sins covered." So here is a great result, isn't it? Sin covered, a multitude of sins covered. Now, remember, we're trying to work out what the melodic line is of the letter. And the interesting thing is that phrases from these last two verses also come much earlier in the book, back in chapter 1. So come back now to chapter 1, and almost as if to frame the big idea of the letter, a bit like kind of bookends at the beginning and an end of the letter, you've got this idea of the soul being saved also comes in chapter 1, verse 21. Therefore put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness. Receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. Interesting. Exactly the same phrase. Souls being saved. And similarly, that idea of wandering off that we've just seen in chapter 5, verse 19, if any of you wanders from the truth, that comes here in chapter 1, verse 16. It's translated in ESV, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers." But actually, the deceived word here is the same as the wandering word, exactly the same. So it's something like, "Don't be led astray, my beloved brothers." And in chapter 5, "If anyone among you is led astray from the truth." Now, we're going to stick in this little bit in chapter 1, trying to work out these kind of bookends of the letter. And those verses there, verse 16, verse 21, are part of a paragraph that runs through from verse 12, certainly down to verse 18, maybe down to verse 21. And there's a picture all the way through this, which is all about the birds and the bees. It's about the facts of life. It's about sex. So an 18 certificate on the next little bit. You've got in your notes a table. Again, turn to your neighbour and see if you can fill in as many of the boxes on this table as you can. You might not be able to fill them all in, but try and spot this image running through these verses. Okay, back in your groups again. And if you filled in the table, there are two questions at the bottom of the page to start discussing as well. Okay, again, let's come back together again. So can you spot the metaphor running, first of all, then through verses 14 and 15? So you've got the idea, haven't you, of desire. When it's conceived, gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's fully grown up, brings forth death. It's a picture of how worldly thinking works. It begins with seduction. Don't you fancy me? Don't you want me? A desire for forbidden fruit. A thought gets implanted. Or I think in this metaphor, a sperm gets implanted. And then bingo, fertilization, conception, embryo, baby, birth. And verse 15, desire gives birth to sin, and the little baby sin grows up to be a killer. Now, can you see it's exactly the same metaphor in verse 18? Can you see it's the same thing there? How is it that God brings us forth? How does God give birth to a Christian? How does that take place? Well, by the word of truth, verse 18. Elsewhere in the New Testament, we know that the word of truth is the gospel. In Colossians 1, verse 5, the word of truth is the gospel. Ephesians 1, 13, it's the gospel of your salvation. And I think it's the same here in James chapter 1. It's God's gospel word. It comes down from him, from above. And God's seed is implanted to bring about new birth. So verse 21, it's implanted, that potent word received into our bodies, implanted there, that inseminates us. And interesting, what it brings forth this time is us. We're the ones who are brought forth, verse 18, as a child, a first fruit, a firstborn, the oldest of his new creation. We are brought forth by the word of truth. So you've got that same pattern, I think, that same image that goes through with them both. So here's the table, and this is how I filled it in. I don't know whether it's quite right, whether I've got the things in the right place, but you get the idea of it. I've had six children, so I know how this works. I've been involved in research for James chapter 1. I know how where babies come from. And what this is saying is that from our desires comes a whole family of children, sin and death. And on the other hand, from the word comes a whole family of children that are brought forth by the word of truth. Now, what is the point here? I think the point here is in verse 16. Don't be deceived or led astray. Don't wander from the truth, because wandering leads to death. That's what we saw in chapter 5, verse 20, wasn't it? Same idea. Wandering leads to death. And you can wander from the word to the world and its desires. See how we've got the same idea here in chapter 1 as we saw in the last two verses in chapter 5. You've got, if you like, worldly thinking, the world and its desires. And if you like, wordy thinking. See what I've done there? And they come from two very different families. And if you think they fit together around the same family meal table, well, really they don't. They are very different families. Desire, sin, death, or word, birth, life. Death or life are the two destinations. And the route to life is by the gospel, the word of truth that saves our souls, and that word implanted into us. But we said that there's something that threatens that saving, this clear and present danger, this danger of wandering, or 1:16, being deceived. So we're still wanting to get clear on James's melodic line. What is the deception? What is the danger? We've got this as a sort of backdrop. What's the deception? And in a word, and this is what we're going to see all the way through the rest of today, in a word, the deception, the danger, is double-mindedness. Actually, literally, two-souledness. Interesting, because it's the same soul word that needs saving. So the soul that needs saving, saved through the implanted word, that is the same soul word that is here translated two-souled or two double-minded. The actual word double-minded just comes twice, in chapter 1, verse 8, and in chapter 4, verse 8. We're just going to begin to understand it in those two places, but the idea runs all the way through the letter. And remember, getting this feel for the book of as a whole makes a difference to how you then come to understand any individual passage. So chapter 1, verse 8, first of all, there is the first reference to being double-minded. Now, that person must not suppose that he'll receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. And in each case, we're given a picture of what the double-mindedness looks like. And here the picture is verse 6. It's a wave. So what is it like to be double-minded? Well, it is to be like a wave. My wife grew up in Eastbourne, and her father still lives there, and we spent many family holidays on the beach in Eastbourne. And we were there last summer, summer before, sitting on the beach, and we had one of those endless conversations that you have in this country of, where should we put the towel and the blanket to sit down? Is the tide coming in or out? And you know, you're adventurous, so you go right to the edge of the water thinking it's going out. Oh no, it's coming in, hang on, we'll move up a bit. No, I think it's going out, we can move down. And we spent 10 minutes just, literally 10 minutes, just trying to work out where we could put our blanket. Was the tide going in or out? And the thing was that the waves just kept coming in and out for 10 minutes, all the time. That's what waves do. And that's exactly the point here, isn't it? The idea of going up and down, looking in two directions, being influenced by two ways of thinking, caught in two minds. Those are all different ways of describing what we're saying, isn't it? And it is, I think, being a Christian and yet being enticed by the world and its attitudes and behaviours. That's what we mean by double-mindedness. Being a Christian and yet being influenced by the world. The other place where the word double-minded gets used is chapter 4, verse 8. Look over to that. Chapter 4, verse 8. Draw near to God, he'll draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. And this time, again, we're given a picture, and here the picture is in chapter 4, verse 4. And the picture we're given here is adultery, playing the field. Being married and having a mistress. So verse 4, trying to be friends with God and friends with the world. Double-minded then. I grew up in a Christian home, and thinking back on my life, me as a teenager is a very good example of what we mean by double-minded. And for those of you who grew up in Christian homes, this may resonate with some of you as well. So as a teenager, on Sunday I went to church 5 times. We're that kind of a family. So I went to a morning, early morning Bible study, then I went to a morning church where I helped with the Sunday school. In the afternoon I went to Crusaders, then in the evening I went to the evening service, then after church I went to YPF. So five different Christian meetings on a Sunday. And I was, to all intents and purposes, you know, a nice keen Christian boy. The rest of the week at school, I don't think anybody at school knew I was a Christian. I was one of the boys. Not in the in-group, because I wasn't sporty. But wanted to be in the in-group. And the way that I wanted to be in the in-group was by not laying on to anybody that I was a Christian. In fact, one of the things that I remember, to my shame, actually, is my father was a children's evangelist, and he came to speak at the school Christian Union, and when his name was announced, Oliver Stiles was coming to speak. I made a great joke amongst my friends about how funny it was the Christian Union had got somebody coming to speak who got the same surname as me. And I wouldn't even admit it to my dad. It's horrible. Now, that's a really good example, isn't it, of double-minded? Definitely looking in two directions. So, church on Sunday, friends with the world during the rest of the week. Now, that's given us, I think, a bit of a feel for James's purpose and for his concern. And what we're going to do now is to turn to chapter 3. Because if there's any doubt about our double-mindedness, if there's any thought that this doesn't really apply to me, if there's any pride in us that makes us think, oh, I'm not a wanderer, or I'm not potentially a wanderer, or I couldn't be deceived like that, well, come and see Dr. James. You know how it is when, if you're not feeling well, and you go and see the doctor, and he says, show me your tongue. I don't know if they still do this anymore, actually. I can't remember the last time a doctor said, show me your tongue, but I remember they used to, in the olden days, before electricity and gas and the wheel and fire and all those kind of things. But you used to say, show me your tongue, and you stick your tongue out and the doctor could see immediately what was wrong with you, or you've got an ingrown toenail or whatever it is. You could just see just by looking at the tongue shows the doctor what's wrong on the inside. And in this chapter, in James chapter 3, James is like a doctor, and he basically says, stick out your tongue. Like a doctor who wants to see what's wrong with you, James is going to do his diagnosis. So let's have a look. Stick out your tongue. And this is going to help me to see how double-minded you are. But before we get there, we've got some other descriptions of what the tongue is like. So first of all, let's see what he says about the tongue. So the first thing he says is that the tongue boasts. Chapter 3, verse 3. If we put bits into the mouths of horses so they obey us, we guide their whole bodies as well. Look at the ships also, though they're so large and driven by strong winds, they're guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also a tongue is a great member, yet it boasts of great things. So the tongue boasts, in the sense, I think, that it packs a big punch, punches above its weight, if you like. And I think the image all the way through these verses is basically, if you can control the small thing, you can control the big thing. So if you can control the bit and bridle in a horse's mouth, then you can control the whole horse. That's verse 3, isn't it? Verse 4, if you can control the rudder, then you can control the whole ocean-going liner as well. And in exactly the same way, verse 5, though the tongue is small, it packs a big punch. And the implication here is, if you could control the small thing, the tongue, you could control the whole person, the big thing. But look at the second half of verse 2. If anybody doesn't stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body. And the whole point is, we can't control the little thing. so we can't control the big thing. In fact, our small tongue, 4 inches of muscle, or whatever it is, our words proclaim our sin, actually. It's small, but it boasts how very big it is. That's the first thing. Second thing, that the tongue burns. So if you look again at verse 5 clarifies here, we really are talking about the tongue. That's the small thing. And second half of verse 5, just as a spark is small compared to a forest fire. You know, you just need a match, a single match, and yet I'm thinking of the fires in Australia several years ago. And it killed a billion animals, apparently. About 700 species of insect were wiped out in one summer through one spark that became a forest fire. Extraordinary. And verse 6 is saying, just as there is a forest full of fire in a little spark, so there is a world full of evil concentrated in our little tongue. The tongue is a fire, verse 6, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. That end phrase is very interesting, isn't it? It's almost as if the world has made our tongue its base of operations in us. You know how Britain establishes its embassy in foreign parts? You know, there's a little bit of England that you can, the United Kingdom, a little bit of Britain you can flee to, you know, if there's a military coup or whatever. And the authority of our government is there. That's the base of its operations in that country, whatever. And what verse 6 is saying is that the world, the evil world, actually, end of verse 6, hell itself has made the center of its operations in our body. Where? Well, it's set up its embassy in our tongues, and its flames are lethal. Sort of mix of metaphors there, but you get the idea, don't you? And then the third thing, the tongue beasts, a made up word, and it's only there because it begins with a B. So the tongue is like a wild beast. It beasts, verse 7. Every kind of beast and bird, of reptile, sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison. So think of all the wild animals in the world and think how wild they are in their wildness. You know, just go to Google and tap in lion attacking its prey. Actually, don't do that because there's some really horrible things that you'll see. But look down again at verse 7. You got, I think, in verse 7, all of creation listed there. The entire animal kingdom, beast, bird, reptile, sea creature. Feral, uncontrollable, dangerous. And yet, verse 7, people have managed to control them all. The whole animal kingdom. We've managed to control them. But verse 8, irony of ironies, there is one wild thing we cannot tame, and that's our tongue. If we could harness its power, if we could control the small thing, we would be able to control the big thing. If we control the bit, we could control the horse. If we could control the rudder, we could control the ship. If we could control the tongue, we could control the whole person. Second half of verse 2. But the whole thing is, we cannot. Now, what is James's point here with this expose of what our tongues is like? James chapter 3 is normally applied as something like this. Since our tongue is so powerful, we must control it. So here is a commentary on James talking about this passage. James chapter 3 verses 1 to 12 is all about words and the importance of all believers using their words in the right way. I think you'd agree, probably that's the way that this passage is normally taught. But what is James's point? Well, look back to the beginning of verse 1 and you'll see here is his application. Not many of you should become teachers. Why not? Turn to your neighbour and talk again. Why should not many of you become teachers? What is the logic of that command here in James chapter 3? This is a puzzle. Okay, let's come back together again. Let's have some of your theories. Why not many teachers? Not many of you should be teachers. Any theories? What's going on here? Explain it to me. You realise that when I do this, it means I have no idea. When I'm saying, anybody got any thoughts? You know, please.
Can we talk about the fact that teachers will face greater judgment?
Yeah, good. Yes. For you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Why?
Well, we talked about a bit about how the sort of metaphors that they're given, like the sparks and such, like what they communicate, impacts the entire the entire body really that they're teaching.
Yeah.
So yeah, what they communicate matters.
You could set your congregation on fire, in a bad sense. Yes. Fiery preachers. Mm. Yeah, good. Any other thoughts?
Teaching involves using the tongue, and we're not very good at doing that
without
causing trouble.
In what way? But same thing as this, or
well, it's more than that. If the base of operations for hell is the tongue, and in teaching we have to use the tongue, that's quite a tricky thing to do in a godly manner.
Yeah. Because what might come out of your tongue might not be very good. Yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking that there's this juxtaposition that it is here again, is that you can use the tongue to use the word of God, or you could use the tongue to use the word of man. Hmm. And it's this balance between it. And so whenever we use the worldly tongue, then it can create all these issues. And whenever we use the word of God, so he's using this juxtaposition between
helpful.
One family and another family, two families.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Double-minded.
Somebody else start to speak. Yeah.
One of the phrases I found very interesting is the phrase that it's when people are looking at our lifestyle a lot. Someone has said, you have the gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and even John, where you have the gospel according to yourself. So we are living epistles. And you as a teacher, you are using your tongue, you are speaking the word, you are communicating truth, but yet still, your life speaks differently from what you are saying.
Okay. So a difference between your words and your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Is there anything here about your life? John thinks there is.
So verse 13, talk about your wisdom and understanding
good.
Not being proclaimed from your mouth, but from your life.
Yeah, good, thank you. Anything more on the not many of you should be teachers
point? I guess the logic isn't that there are some people that are really bad at taming their tongue, so just keep them away, but it's that every single person has this, and it's really, really dangerous. So that means if everyone's a teacher, it's just going to be an absolute nightmare.
Chaos.
It's not just like 90% are, just not those 10. It's everyone's got this problem.
Yeah. Which is interesting, isn't it? Because it's a different... how do you work out, in church life, who you should be encouraging to become a Bible teacher? Well, start from the assumption that not many. Assume the worst. Let's start from that as a base. Yeah. So, not many teachers then. Why not? Well, as we notice, look down at the passage. Because we know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness, verse 1. Actually, more accurately, as you put it, with greater, i.e. more judgment. The strict word isn't actually in there. It's we'll be judged with more judgment. So I don't think it is that there is greater strictness in the sense of a different standard of judgment for teacher. You come to the judgment day and it's kind of, you're a teacher, oh, you go that side. You're not a teacher, oh, that's fine, you'll be right over there. Teacher, we want to go that way. Because that's the really strict side, but that's the lenient side. I don't think it's that there are two standards of judgment. I think it is more that there's just greater judgment, i.e. simply more of it. There's only one standard of judgment that God has. Now, why then? Why will teachers be judged with more judgment? Well, because of what we say That's how James continues in verse 2. We all stumble, or we all fail, we sin in many ways. Now, interesting, he's already used the word in chapter 2, verse 10. He's already used the word stumbling. It's translated in ESV, whoever keeps the law but fails in one point. It's the same stumbles word. And at that point, his point was, we'll come and look at this a bit later on today, but his point there is, if we fail at one point, we fail a lot. And I think that's the same idea here in too, that we all fail in loads of ways, because you only have to fail in one way and you fail in loads. And the words we say prove that point, I think, is the idea here. So every time we open our mouths, every time we say something, that exposes how sinful we are. And the greater the number of words, the greater judgment we can expect because of our words, our failing words, our stumbling words, our sinful words, verse 2. Our tongue shows our failings. It's evidence that we all stumble in many ways. If you want to know that I stumble in many ways, just listen to the microphone. And of course, teachers are all about words, aren't they? Words are the teacher's tool. You can't be a teacher without words. Can you need words to be a teacher? Apparently, on average, we speak about 7,000 words a day. So today I'm going to use up three and a half days worth of my quota just being here. Yeah, that makes the point, doesn't it? If you're a teacher, use more words. And the more words I say, the more evidence there's going to be to condemn me. So I think it is teachers will receive more judgment because they speak more words. Words on which the judge can assess and convict and condemn lawbreakers. I don't know if this is a helpful analogy, but it reminded me of being a school pupil or a college student who is very in awe of their teacher. You know, Cornhill students, how you're so in awe of John, right? For me, it was Miss Woods when I was in the equivalent of year six, and I think I probably had a crush on her. She was my teacher. Beryl Wood, I remember. I remember the shock of discovering that she smoked. And it kind of, I caught her in a staff room and she went massively down in my estimation. But she was the one I had the crush on. And I didn't want to say the wrong thing because I didn't want to show myself up by saying something stupid. So Miss Wood thought that I was a very, very quiet member of the class. But it's all because I was so in love with Miss Wood. You know, say less because then you look better than you know you actually are. That was my motto. Now, I think that's something of how James applies this stuff about the tongue. Remember, it's a diagnostic passage. And it's a strange application in verse 1. It's a very strange application for a day like today, isn't it? My job is to train Bible teachers. Here at a conference for preachers and wannabe Bible teachers. And here is a strange text. Not many of you should do it. You might think, after all that we've seen at the beginning and end of the letter and this issue of double-mindedness, you might think that what a double-minded church needs is more teachers, not less. But here is my first application for us this morning. Not many teachers. Avoid Bible teaching. Not avoid hearing Bible teaching, but giving it. So James is a Bible teacher, but he wouldn't recommend it. Hearers, yes. Doers, yes. Teachers, not so much. Because ministry is so wordy, so exposed, so exposing. There are just so many opportunities as I stand at the front for me to show you my sin. Actually, for me to sin, to be a lawbreaker. So that's why not many of you should become teachers. It's just worth pausing on this. We'll come back to this after coffee in just a moment, but Christian character matters more than the gift of the gab, doesn't it? And we're so easily deceived about this, and self-deceived as well. It's Christian character that's got to be weighed when you're appointing church elders, isn't it? Of course, they've got to be able to teach, but that's one instruction amongst loads about character. I don't know whether this is true, but somebody said this to me a little while ago, and it stuck with me, that in church life we tend to appoint on the basis of gifts, but fire on the basis of character. So watch out for that double-mindedness. But James's second point, he comes to, I think, in verses 9 to 12 that we haven't looked at yet, the bit that comes after that description of what the tongue is like. And that is, I think, here that we have a divided tongue in verses 9 to 12. With our tongue, we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. Aesop, who wrote Aesop's Fables, I was once asked what is the most useful thing in the world, and he replied, the tongue. And he was then asked what is the most harmful thing in the world, and he replied, the tongue. Useful and harmful. We bless and we curse, verse 9. Just have to be in any of our cars, don't you? Got a worship CD in that you're singing along to. And then some idiot cuts in front of you and you shout at them. profanities, probably, from safe inside your car. You only got to listen to me to know I'm a sinner. Of course, nice things comes out of my mouth as well, but also deadly poison. And of course, if you could listen to me 24/7, you'd never listen to what you're listening to now. I do stumble in what I say, verse 2. It's a bit like, you know, if you're carrying a tray of coffee cups. Oh, talking of which, not long. A bit like you're carrying a tray of coffee cups and they're all full to the brim and you bump into somebody. What happens? Well, the coffee spills out of the cups, right? So you bump into somebody and what comes out, what spills out of their mouths is what's inside them. The mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That's what Jesus said, isn't it? What is in there comes up. Or to change the analogy, I particularly like this one, what's down in the well comes up in the bucket. So chapter 3, I think James is saying, stick your tongue out. Show me your tongue, because our mouths are where our minds come into the open, so to speak. And my tongue is forked, verse 10. We both bless and curse. Now, I think verses 11 and 12 are saying it shouldn't be like this. These things ought not to be. It doesn't even make sense that it's like this. You can't get fresh and salt water from a spring of... And yet, how is it that you can get blessing and cursing from the same person? It doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't be like that, but it is. So, believe me now, on the basis of your tongue, that we are divided, we're double-minded, we're wobblers because we live with our feet in two camps, two different worlds. So we live our lives, don't we? We can't escape our lives in this world. We live here, we talk to people here, we watch things on the telly here, we read things in blogs, things which are very much of this world, things that reflect a view of the world, a value system, that's very different from our Christian perspective. Of course we do. We imbibe it. It's all around us. And at the same time, our foot is firmly in the Christian camp. We're Christians. We hear things at church. We say things at church. We read things in our Bibles. Other Christians say things to us, and they are a very different view of things. And that is the problem that James calls double-mindedness, I think. Being Christians, thinking as Christians, behaving as Christians, and at the same time living in this world, thinking in worldly ways, behaving in worldly ways. Living as a Christian and as a non-Christian. And if you doubt it, stick your tongue out. Show me your tongue. Point made, right? So I take it that we are the very people that James is concerned about. We are the wobbly, two-faced Christian. We are the very people who ourselves are in danger of wandering from the truth. So when we look at the end of chapter 5, you immediately, I reckon, were thinking of other people that we might be the hero to and do the bringing back. So just rethink the end of chapter 5. So we are the people who need to be brought back, the potential wanderer. I remember when I was studying James some years ago at church, and it was a home group Bible study, and we were looking at these passages together. And we're a couple of weeks into James, and I remember somebody saying, you know, hey, I'm a wobbly Christian. This could be written for me. And it led to a discovery all round the group, as all of us were admitting, yeah, in some ways we are wobbly Christians. However strong we think we are, actually the pressure from all around us influencing our desires is so strong. We are all, in some sense, wobbly Christians. And if you're in any doubt, stick your tongue out, let's go and have coffee. You might want to, not many of you should talk during the coffee break. Not many of you should spill coffee during the coffee break. Good, we're taking half an hour now, is that right? Half an hour's break now.